This meeting is now being recorded.
And it is now being recorded. So for those that don't know, I'm Jake Chatters, one of the co-chairs. Judge Earl is on the phone as well. So we'll go to roll here in a second. But normally she'd be running the meetings, but since she's on the phone, I will attempt to do so in her place. For those listening on the phone, the public members are passive, and so they can hear, but there isn't an ability to join the conversation. The subcommittee members, you are active, and so you can speak up and jump in when you need to. For those that are here, just remember to please be careful of moving of papers, and if you're like me and do click your pen, the microphones on the phone system are very sensitive, and they'll pick all that up and make it difficult to hear for those that are on the line. Okay, so I will go through roll call real quickly. So Kimberly Flenner.
Here.
Judge Good. Terry Carter.
Here.
Rick Feldstein.
Here.
Judge Boris. We didn't expect to be attending, so okay. Jake Chatters, I'm here. Debbie Norrie.
Here.
Judge Cope.
I'm here.
Judge Earl.
I'm here.
Judge Slough.
Present.
Chris Volkers.
Here.
Mike Roddy. Okay. Judge Walsh.
Here.
Skip John Fitton.
Here.
David Yamasaki.
Here.
Judge Masanaga.
Present.
And Mary Beth Todd.
Present.
Okay. So it looks like Mike Roddy might join us later. We'll...
He's running it just a minute.
Oh, yes. Okay. So he'll join us when possible. And then we do have here in the room a number of individuals from Judicial Council staff. So that includes, let's go around the room, Jody Patel, Kurt Soderlund, Stephen Chang. We have Andy Liebenbaum. I always pronounce it wrong. We have Corey Jasperson, Don Will. We have
Jared
too. We have Bob and Blanca. Anybody I miss? Okay. So let's see. We did not think we had any written comments, but we did get one 2 minutes ago, so I don't have it yet, but we did receive one written comment, correct? But again, it was just received 2 minutes ago.
That has been emailed to members, and we'll have it posted online.
Okay. And there, unless Jared, did you want to make a public comment? Okay. So other than that, I don't believe there's anybody who's here present who would make public comment. Okay. So I think we will move on, right, Flacco? Anything else we need to cover?
No, I think we're good.
So let's go on to, we have four agenda items today. In your materials, items one and two are somewhat connected. So depending on the discussion of item one, we may or may not have further discussion on two. So the first item is the allocation of the trial court trust fund funding shortfall fiscal year. As you may recall, the Judicial Council did allocate that funding shortfall based on a methodology that was consistent with how the 2% funding holdback was identified and developed. They did, however, there was some discussion leading into that. We did not make a recommendation for them to allocate that at this time. The Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee did not. So the council did leave open that should the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee wish to suggest an alternative method, that they would be willing to hear that further recommendation. So it's really back here with us as the subcommittee to determine whether or not we want to recommend to the Budget Advisory Committee that different action should be taken. Fair?
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Judge Earl has any comments. As she was present at the council meeting. And for the record, we have Mike Roddy now in attendance for role. So Judge Earl, did you have anything you'd like to add regarding the topic and the discussion?
Hearing none.
Judge Earl on the line and available?
Anybody on the line?
Is the line active for...
I'm here. Okay. Are you there?
Yes, we are.
Okay. I do want to give just some background information. I also want to welcome everybody to the meeting and thank you for attending. And I apologize that I am not able to attend in person. And Jake has stepped up for me, which I appreciate. I did just want to give some background. As you know, when we discussed this last, it was the position of our funding methodology subcommittee, and it was also the position of the budget advisory committee that the reduction not be allocated at this time, that the council make an allocation that assumes that the revenue shortfall would be fully backfilled or funded, and that we continue to work with the Department of Finance on filling that. The council, there was very, there was a lot of discussion, and some of you in the room I know were there, but they rejected that recommendation. They made an allocation that assumed that we would not get that backfilled, and they really rejected it, at least in my mind, on based on two things. One, they were unwilling to engage in what they called deficit spending. They felt, the comments were, they felt that was irresponsible to both the public and to trial courts in general. And they also were unwilling to upset our relationship with the governor or Department of Finance. And the comments were that by assuming that the money would be backfilled and making an allocation that included that, that we would potentially upset those relationships. So they rejected that. They, you might recall that we had discussions about the different options for allocating the reduction. Those options are included in the materials. I believe it's attachment 1B. We had preliminary discussions. We determined, and the Budget Advisory Committee determined, that options 3 and 4 were probably the most viable options. So those two options were included in the report to the council. They weren't included as a recommendation. They were included just as the two most viable options that we saw, but I did advise them that we had not arrived at a recommendation. So they selected option 4, which is similar to how the 2% reserve money is allocated, and as Jake said, they sent it back to us to recommend a different allocation method if we came up with a different one. I was asked by some of our committee members, including Judge Walsh, to revisit all four options in our discussion. That's why your spreadsheet has all four of the options that we initially saw. And we are at the point now where we need to come up with a recommendation, whether it's similar to the council's or not. So I've asked Jake to walk us through all of the options and allow full discussion on that, and I'm happy to answer any questions about the Judicial Council meeting and the tenor of that meeting if anyone would like me to.
Okay, so not hearing any questions, on page 4 of the materials, labeled page 4 of the materials, is the start of the spreadsheet that shows what the four allocations were that we had discussed previously. So I want to walk through what how each of those were calculated. And please, if I get any of this wrong, anyone can step in and correct me. So column with label column 1 would have been using the pro rata share of that production using each court's historical base. So that would have been all of our shares prior to the implementation of the funding model. The second column would have been doing a pro rata distribution of that production using the percentage of WAFM funding need for each court. So that would be 100, you know, basically allocating it using what each court needs as the percentage of their share rather than what they had prior to implementation of WAFM. And so in essence, that option really would have been to just reduce the amount that courts were receiving from new money. So instead of allocating 100% of new money, it would have been 100% less, $22.7 million. Column 3 was using a pro rata that was based on the 2014-15 total base funding for each court. So that then combines some portion of historic funding, some portion of new funding, and sort of makes a split, splits the difference between the two of those using our existing base. What ultimately was adopted by the council was option 4, which is very close to number 3. The only difference is that it takes out security for those courts that still have marshal service or other security funding. So that's the same way that the 2% reserve method is calculated and was the one that was ultimately adopted by the council. So there's not a whole lot of difference you'll see in the numbers for each court between option 3 and 4, except for those that have marshal service. And then the rest is spread out among the rest of us. So those are the four options. there's any questions on that, I can certainly answer those. Otherwise, just sort of open it up for discussion.
Can I ask a question? I was at the council meeting, and I was at the budget advisory meeting that made the initial recommendation. The budget advisory committee approach was, they said they're giving us $86 million. If they don't, it's a reduction. But the council said, loudly and clearly, no, they're not giving you $86 million. They're giving you $63 million. And to be responsible, we have to then allocate 63, not 86, and then cross our fingers that we get the backfill. I think that's pretty clear. That's what they said. So it seems to me that our approach here is not dealing with the ultimate question, which is a big one, and we're going to deal with that with item two. How do you deal with the reduction? Because there was no reduction, according to the council. Our allocation was 63, 64 million. So it seems to me that we ought to treat the distribution of that quote-unquote new money pursuant to WAFM. That's what WAFM stands for. What would the number be if we allocated $64 million? Because that's what the council did. What I'm not clear on, I think I know the answer, but I'm not clear on which of these columns, if applied, and I'll ask one of our experts, Zaka or Steve Chang, to tell me, would accomplish what I described. Or say it another way, what I think we now that the council's active, what we should do is just do a run. Do what the council said. We got $64 million allocated pursuant to WAFM. What's that number, and that's your allocation. To know what the effect is, though, I think one of these would tell us, and I think it benefits Santa Clara County to the tune of $174,000, $175,000, but I could be wrong. So, Steve or Zonka, which one, if we just saw a run out for $64 million, how would that affect us with one of these four dollars?
So, I'll answer that since Steve is not at the microphone here. But I think the answer, Judge Walsh, is what you state. It's the difference between column two and column four.
Okay.
So, for example,
So column two would be if they had allocated $64 million pursuant to WAFM, which is what I think they did, which is what we should do. Then it's column two. And it's not really a reduction, it's just simply a WAFM allocation. But to be clear, the delta between that and four, it's not $1 million here and there. It's I ran the numbers. It's the biggest one is LA, if we did that, loses $399,000. And the biggest winner might be San Francisco that gains $182,000. I'm not trying to base this on, you know, look at your parochial interest. But just so you know, what's in play here is not millions in per court. It's thousands. And I'll show you the individual numbers. I just think I was there. They said you have $64 million to allocate. That's what we should do. And not pretend we got 86, which we never did. And then pretend we got a reduction, which we never did. But go with the reality of what we have.
In my recollection, they didn't do a net.
Yeah.
They looked at a plus as the augmentation, and that was one action. And then the fact that the base was shorted was a separable action and therefore acted upon differently as opposed to a net, because you would have a difference of matching funds on the 86 versus doing a $64 million net allocation. So if I recall it, they were sort of two, augmentation on one end and then underfunding the TCTF shortfall separately, not that the council sees it, said it's a $64 million.
That's the only figures we gave them. We didn't do the separate math. What I'm saying is the net effect of what they did was adopt a 60. What they wanted to achieve was $64 million, because that's what you had.
But I think that's a different point. That might be the net effect. But I agree. I was at the meeting as well. My recollection of it as well is consistent with as described by Vlad Code. Maybe that is the net effect, but that that wasn't my impression of their intention of saying, here, you have this money to allocate.
Other comments?
I think what Judge Walsh said makes perfect logical sense, but it's another way of also logically approaching it in terms of this money didn't come to the courts. It was in our budget from prior years. It did not come to the courts through WAFM. It was just part of our normal allocation. And so to redistribute it with WAFM and instead of distribute it, it's just a redistribution of old money. And I don't know that that's really what we want to do. Really, typically when you see these kinds of reductions, usually you take the money out in the way that it came in. And it's part of our total base. And if you're going to take it out, then you do it on a pro rata basis of the total base or the 2% reserve method, using sort of a line of logic that way as well.
When you say total base, then and take out, are you talking about three now? Three.
Could be three or four,
or
really,
four,
because we're 2% adjustment, which is, I think, a little bit more, it's more consistent if we go the 2% route with other reductions that we take.
I think one of the other elements that I look at it is, it is a net effect of 66, right? But the difference is, in one, it's a permanent augmentation of the 80 some million.
What we hope is only a one-time shortfall of 22 million. And so if you were to do it only allocating 66 net as new money, then we're going to end up at some point having 20 some million that has to get allocated under some method as new money. Instead of it being, but at that point it's not new money. How do we identify it? How do we know it came in, right? Instead it's just sort of phantom money that is cash. And I don't mean that like it's hidden. It's just, it's not an identifiable, here was the action, and now suddenly that money is there to allocate. We'd have to be tracking it in some way. And so I think what the council was trying to do, I mean, and again, we didn't make initially a recommendation, but when they ultimately decided to do it, is to allocate the $80 million as this is new money, it came in, permanent, ongoing, versus what we hope to be a $22 million one-time shortfall. Whether that pans out, I don't think we know. Is there anyone on the phone who wants to discuss this item?
Jake, I can. This is Judge Earl. I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I also agree with Judge Slough that what the council did was they allocated the 86.3 pursuant to WAFM, and then they allocated the 22.7 separately using the 2% reserve method. I did address at the council meeting that we had preliminary discussions about allocating the 22.7 under WAFM, including just subtracting the 22.7 from the 86, and told them that preliminarily we had rejected those as not being viable. But again, there was no recommendation that went before them. And my goal, I think, in doing this is just to stay true to the intent of WAFM, to make sure that those courts that WAFM intends to provide more of an allocation based on their workload than their historical allocation would, don't get punished by taking a bigger hit of a reduction when it comes in as well.
Okay, so I guess the question here is, you know, our options are obviously we could take no action, make no recommendation of any changes, or separately recommend a different alternative. So,
Mike.
It seems
Jake.
To me, Mike Roddy's
okay. Comment.
It seems to me we're at this point where I believe we're viewing this as a one-year issue and hoping that we get this money restored next year. The council took the action they took. It seems to me we leave this alone. If the money comes back in next year, it ought to be allocated out the way it was. It failed to be allocated this year so that the courts would be made whole in column four. From a planning perspective, we've all seen the numbers and probably planned in that direction. But to reopen the can of worms and all the associated issues around that seems to me not very productive given the amount of money and the fact that council's already made that call. I may not necessarily like the option. I share Judge Walsh's concerns, but on the other hand, it's done. It's the council did it, whether we like it or not. They didn't punt it back to us to come up with another option. And as long as we commit to when the funds get restored, and I'm going to assume that they will next year, that they get back to the courts in the same way they were taken out under this specific recommendation.
I'm going to make that motion, Mike.
I'll make that motion.
I'll second that.
Okay, so the motion, if we're defeated, is that there's no recommendation for a change in how the council allocated the $22.7 million reduction in the current year. However, a affirmation that when that money is restored, it should be restored pro rata equal to that the way the reduction was taken. Is that
when the funds are restored, they're restored in the same manner in which they were removed for this specific item, the $22.7 million.
All right, so it was moved by Mike Roddy and seconded by Mary Beth Todd. Some discussion.
So the only point that I would bring up, and I'm going to be in vote in support of the motion, but the thing that I think we need to be cognizant of is what's the answer to when money is reduced and how it's going to be applied, because you can't take this scenario and rely upon it going forward exclusively. There's going to have to be a very detailed discussion about that new question. Today, we're moving in the positive direction. 6 years from now, and it goes the other way, it's going to be a problem. So that's one of the reasons for kind of looking at the approach that Judge Walsh was talking about, is using Walmart as the tool for the distribution of money's income when they go out.
I think we'll go to on the second item, we'll end up talking more detail about future, hopefully never cuts, but future cuts. Any further discussion?
Take a vote.
Okay. Do you think we need to do a roll call?
No.
All right. So then we'll take a vote. So all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any
aye.
Opposed? Sorry. Any opposed?
No. That's good argument.
Okay. All right. So the motion carries. All right. So then moving on to item number two is to David's point. I mean, Dave did the lead-in really. The question then becomes one of the items. There's no materials for this in the packet. It's just an agenda item. One of the outstanding items on the work plan related to WAFM was how would we allocate reductions. So when we went through the process initially, our hope was that we wouldn't have any reductions in the short term to allocate, and so we did not take a formal position within the methodology on how that would be done in the future. So certainly as this topic came up over the summer, we didn't have an answer that was already built in, and so the question that David's brought up is, do we want to establish a standard way that unallocated reductions would be allocated, right? So if the legislature certainly comes through and the governor and says that they are going to reduce court-appointed counsel, obviously this hasn't ever been said, but since it's on our agenda, then we would deal with that reduction related to court-appointed counsel, however it was directed. But if it came through that it was an unallocated, unspecified reduction, do we want to have a way that's already predefined within WAFM to make that reduction happen? So I think that's the question we want to talk about. So I think there's two parts to it. One is, do we want to pre-establish what that methodology will be now for planning purposes? Maybe yes, maybe no. And if the answer to that is yes, do we know what option we want to use and to present and build into the methodology going forward? So I don't know if Dr. Earl, if you had anything else you wanted to mention on that topic, or if we just want to open it up for discussion.
Yeah, I don't have anything else.
I personally have a problem predetermining the future because it could come in any number of different ways in specific areas, for example, or in the general fund type area. I think it's one we need to wrestle with as we continue moving forward with WAFM because the equation will continue to change. It's not as though we're in a static, fixed funding system right now. We're still moving money around. I would prefer to address that issue when it arises, how it arises, with the then, for the sake of argument, then current members of the committee or subcommittee, because that could change as well. And since we typically as a branch have a problem with successors honoring prior commitments, why would we do that to ourselves again? So I'm not into predetermination at this point. I like to take it as it comes.
I absolutely agree with Mike. I mean, our money comes to us in so many different ways and for so many different purposes. WAFM is still very new. We're still figuring it all out, what the rules are. I think it's way too soon to make that sort of determination in my caucus issue.
Are there principles of, that we might the worth discussing that don't lock us in, but sort of establish at least the kinds of things we think would be worthy of considering as we go forward, or is that still premature just for the purpose of our group here today?
I think what's hard is this example we just dealt with is one, we don't know if this is one time or not, or if this is just a new way of reducing our allocations. We don't know. And I think if we predetermine in advance, it allows whoever to decide how to slice and dice our budget to kind of use that against us or use that as a strategy on how they might want to allocate mm-hmm. in the future. And I think, and then we'd end up chasing our tail sure. because then we'd be changing it again. I think everything's so uncertain and, you know, for too many things, time will tell for this. Hopefully this was a one-time issue and we handled it appropriately. But if next year it happens again, we might have to start thinking, I think this is just a new way to allocate less money to us and maybe we do have to, you know, consider what Judge Walsh proposed. So I agree with Mike and Rick for that reason. Yes.
Okay. So there are no other comments on the topic then?
Can I ask a question? Is the contemplation here that, let me just make up numbers, if this year or next year we get 80, how do you allocate the 20? Is that what the question is?
Correct.
Then why wouldn't the answer be that in the year in which you get 80, you allocate it as under WAFL? Just whatever the formula is at that point, WAFL allocate the amount of money that the branch is getting. Well, I'm not quite sure I understand what the question is being asked.
You're talking about a reduction in, so the 100 is a baseline amount, and they're going to reduce our.
Well, in fiscal 18-19, we get 100. In fiscal 19-20, we get 80. In fiscal, we allocate it.
I think maybe the concept is, like in this case, we had this plus on one side and a minus on another, and so the discussion is if you do WAFM, then you just do the net number. If it was a pure reduction, then it might be a different discussion because, again, WAFM, maybe at that point we'll have been far enough into WAFM that it can work as WAFM, but since we're not that far away from WAFM implementation in this year, preserving some level of the historical funding methodology, since you would have the greater share of the reduction going to the courts that are going to have the greater portion now of WAFM, whereas historically they'd have a lesser, so they get a bigger chunk of the cut, yet we haven't really distributed much of the money under the WAFM. So that's why I think we're there now. In 4 or 5 years from now, well, you know, when we're, you know, at 50%, then I think the argument could be more persuasive that WAFM then is the most appropriate way. But you'd be really disadvantaging the courts that are the recipient courts in that they would then take a larger share of money that they never got.
One of the differences, if we were fully funded under, so if we were at 100% of our funding need in funding, then Judge, you're correct. All that would happen with the next year is you get 90% of funding, then everybody just gets 90% of their need, and there wouldn't be any discussion. I think it's because it's also we're in the middle of this transition. We're not 100%. So, you know, how does it come in?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, here's a question that Stephen put in my ear is, in the future, would we do then the opposite of the match as well? And undo a part of WAFM as it's a retreat of the funding, but again, that's where we would be at the time might be worthy of that discussion. As we're doing ads and we're matching dollar for dollar, should then future, if we're, you know, at, you know, our council approved WAFM implementation, then do the opposite. Well, they've retreated from and therefore we're going to undo a portion of the match. The questions I think that would be posed out in the future.
Yeah, I agree with Mike. Predicting the future is so hard, as we see with item one. Reductions can come in all sorts of different forms. So I think the answer would be, well, it depends. Particularly, you know, we heard a scenario last that this year we got, what, $223 million new money. Well, it wasn't really new money. I really do think it makes sense to wait until you have the subjects in front of you. Ideally, you'll have an appointed time that will be based on the specifics and the legal government.
Jay, can
you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. My phone's kind of on the fritz. I agree with what has been said, that it might be difficult to make a hard and fast rule about how to handle future reductions, because I think it is dependent on if it's a one-time versus an ongoing versus what type of a reduction. But I do think that we have to stay true to the WAFM principles. We worked very hard to create the principles. We now are at a point where our commitment needs to be demonstrated to both the governor and the legislature, and I think they expect that. So I do think that the overarching principles should be that we are committed to WAFM, and that's, I guess, my only comment, is that I agree that we can't really make any rules because it does depend on what it is we're reducing, but that we do have to keep those principles in mind.
So,
are those identified somewhere, those principles?
Do we have principles identified? I don't, I mean, I,
you know,
I don't
know. I think we do, Jake. I think that in some of the materials that we prepared for the council when WAFM was presented as a funding methodology, there may be some things there that we could look at, and that might be something that we could do through some subcommittee or something else to kind of put together the overarching principles. But I'm sure there's something that was in the presentation or the materials that we presented.
This is like, are you meaning what is the goal of WAFM, you know, in terms of, you know, appropriate funding based on workload, you know, those types of concepts? Yeah, I mean, that would have underlied the entire argument for why we're doing it. So that would be definitely in those concepts.
Do we have a fact sheet on WAFM? I don't even know.
Corey and then we've written up in all different sorts of ways.
It might be in there already.
You can speak up, maybe you can hear that. You can make a move.
Yeah, the WAFM, the high level of WAFM is outlined in the Chief's blueprint that we used last year.
I guess, Sherry, are you, well, I'll put out there, I think one of the other principles was the equalization was an important principle of WAFM, and I think that definitely would play into, you know, future decisions on how you would allocate reductions, keeping in mind that was one of the prime principles, was to come up with some form of parity or equalization of the distribution of funding.
So I guess I have two questions just for intent. I mean, I guess on the one hand, Sherry, to your point, we could, as a group here, work on or review what's already been put in place that defines what WAFM is and see whether or not we want to add in some clear, you know, principles that take it out of the initial report, not adding anything to it from what was initially adopted, but making it clear whether here's a document that, yes, is being produced. I mean, is that something we should do through the committee, or is that really just a request to staff to work on that?
I mean, I suggest it could just be an assignment to staff and circulated. I mean, it's everybody agreed. If we've already approved WAFM, we're just making sure that our documentation and sort of the digestible document is something we all agree to and understand, as it represents what's already been approved by the council.
Jake, this is Ginger Earl. You know what? I think that's a great idea that you've touched upon. I think not everybody on the subcommittee was part of the original subcommittee that developed WAFM. And we did have discussions about kind of principles of WAFM that we wanted to make sure that we followed in the future. And to Mike Roddy's comment, new people rotate off this committee. So I think between you and I and Zlatko and Stephen, we can dig through our presentation that we made to the council about WAFM, and we could kind of outline what those principles are and bring them to our next meeting and kind of get an affirmative action on what the principles of WAFM are. I think that might be helpful.
Okay. Yep, that sounds good. Okay, so then the second part of it is whether you know, based on this discussion, I mean, it definitely feels like the consensus of the group is sort of not to set a hard and fast rule of how to deal with reduction. So we have it on our work plan as one of the items we're going to, you know, still out there and not addressed. And so
I guess I would just say our only real decision then is to remove it from that, but we don't see it necessary to develop something specific, right? And then just to remove it from your work plan. I don't think we can do anything.
No, you're right. I mean, we have our parking lot list,
right?
And in essence, we've discussed it, and I think it's sort of resolved.
I mean, it would be nice to think that at some point we'd be at some sort of a steady state for how our budget occurs, but it's not going to be in the near term, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, so, I mean, unless there's any objection, I guess, we can just handle it as we've discussed it. No, we're not going to develop a standard set, and we'll remove it from the work plan. It's just being finished.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it needs a motion to actually affirmably adopt it. I think we're in agreement as a group on that point.
All right. So let's go to item number three.
Jake, before you move from that, I think it would be helpful to have a formal motion so that we have it in our minutes and it doesn't. It's not just the tenor of the group. I think we need a formal motion to say we're not going to conscientiously not going to develop a policy, but going to handle reductions on a case by case basis.
And Judge Earl, I would add to that that in addition to a case-by-case, it's based on the type of reduction. If it's an ongoing, it would be handled very differently, in my opinion, than if it's a one-time based on unique circumstances.
Is that a motion?
Yes.
So you want to repeat that one, Sherry?
I would make the motion that we not develop a policy for reductions because the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee should consider factors with each reduction, including whether or not the reductions are ongoing versus one time and on what basis the reductions are being made.
Okay.
So the second.
Sorry.
Nick, Goldstein. All right. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? I won't. That was a fire engine. It just passed unanimously. The motion passes unanimously.
Okay. All right. So then on to number three, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So number three relates, the issue at hand is how employer-provided member contributions towards retirement, how those should be treated within WAFM. So just as there are materials that begin on page number eight or seven of your number eight if you're looking at it electronically, seven if you're looking at the page numbers on the bottom of your page. As we all recall, benefit increases were allocated to the branch this year. However, that number was reduced by roughly $22 million, and that was an estimate done by DOS staff of the amount of funds paid by the various trial courts towards the employee share of retirement costs. So again, real quickly there, just to pause, there are two portions of retirement costs. There is the employer share of retirement and the employee share of retirement. And then there are times where the employer pays a portion of the employee share of retirement. So there's only two portions, the employer share and the employee share. The topic here is not, we're not discussing the employer share of retirement. That is an amount that is determined by each retirement system. But instead we're focusing on the issue here relates to any time that the employer pays a portion of the employee share of retirement. So it's often abbreviated to the EPMC, so employer paid member contribution. So if we say EPMC as we walk through it, that's what it stands for, employee paid member contribution. So this was brought up in the Budget Act. The amount of increase for benefit growth was reduced by an amount estimated by DOS staff of all trial court cumulative expenditures toward the employee share of retirement, and that totaled $22 million. So when the council acted in July, it did reduce that
on a pro rata basis for all of us. So rather than allocating the 54.8 million to everyone and then reducing the amount for those courts that pay a portion of the employee share, all of us just shared in that $22 million reduction. So only the 40-some million was allocated out. In the materials is an excerpt in the narrative here from Mr. Michael Cohen, the director of the State Department of Finance's address to the Judicial Council in August, in which he addressed a specific topic. And he reiterates that they are encouraging every branch of government to move towards the standards as they are listed in the 2012 Pension Reform Act. I'll go into a little more about that in a moment. He then talked about that $22 million was an effort to achieve parity with the executive branch, and that's what they viewed it moving forward in that regard.
So, Jake, I just want clarification. Parity with the executive branch workers who got money for a raise, right?
Well, he did not address that specifically, but his statement was just to achieve parity. So I'm just summarizing the quote that's in the material. So then we get – so that was a one-time action of the Court Budget Advisory Committee recommended to the council to deal with that benefits reduction as a one-time reduction, and that it still will have to be addressed ongoing in future budgets. So the question really for us is how to handle the employee-paid member contribution in WAFA. And we're talking about that in a very narrow look. Right, so I want to do a couple things. I want to back up and talk about how are we handling benefits in WAFM again, just to remind ourselves. So in WAFM, what happens is there is an FTE count that comes out of the RAS model, right? And then there's a salary amount that is identified statewide, which is then adjusted in each county based on our Bureau of Labor Statistics factor for our county. So that gets us a not really salary, but a amount of money that is intended to address the workload and salary associated with that workload. We then add to that an amount that would help address benefits, and that benefits breaks down in two primary categories. We separate both of those categories into operations versus program 10 versus program 90. So, but leaving that aside for a second, we separate into two categories. One is a salary-driven benefit, and one is a non-salary-driven benefit. Non-salary-driven benefits typically are health benefits, dental, vision, those sorts of things. So, again, we're not going to talk about that piece. Instead, what's left is the salary-driven benefits factor. And that salary-driven benefits factor is made up of our employer-paid, our employer share of retirement, any employer-paid member contribution, and then Social Security, Medicare, other amounts of benefits that fluctuate based on the salaries that are being paid. So as it stands now, every court's salary-driven benefit factor is based on whatever we currently have. So whatever my employer share of retirement is through our CalPER, or county's CalPERS contract, is what we pay, and whatever Santa Clara is, they get exactly the way that percentage exists today. When we built the model, we really didn't talk about the employee paid member share at all. That is included currently in that category. So if a court is paying the employee share of retirement, that's in that factor, and they get that amount of money today. And if they don't pay it, they don't get any money for it. So it is based on what your actual numbers are. So the question for us is, if we're looking at what these sort of principles were of WAFM, which would be good for us to define those, but in theory, if we're looking towards parity, what does parity look like? Is that parity where some courts are receiving that as part of their need and some courts aren't, as one argument? A separate argument is that is a cost that court has to deal with. Those payments for the members are in union contracts. They've been there for a long time. That is part of the benefits package that is currently there for those employees. It is an existing cost. So those are sort of the two competing issues.
Jake, you just said something that concerns me because it's not true, and I'm not saying you're not being truthful, but we aren't getting the necessary funding for salary-driven benefits.
I'm sorry, you're right. I'm sorry. The need, it is identifying the need. You're correct.
Because we're funded so underfunded in the formula, we're getting 6 cents on the dollar, or 60% of the 60 cents on the dollar. So I want to be careful with that. Because
yes, you're correct. Let me rephrase that to be clear. So this is the need calculation, not what courts are receiving. So the need is being driven and being calculated based on that amount of money. Whether the court gets it or not depends on our full funding, and in most cases you're not, nobody's fully funded, so you're not getting all of it. But the need is calculating your need based on that percent percentage of retirement share. So I want to separate two other, so does that make sense on what's being calculated? So I want, there's another issue that's come up that we want to make sure we're being careful on too, and that's this discussion of, well, are we talking about whether or not courts need to take steps to address the employee paid member contribution, right? So PEPRA goes into effect, the Public Employee Pension Reform Act, defines what is a normal share of retirement and specifies that the employee should pay 50% of the normal share of retirement. So what is the normal share of retirement? Well, there is some way that they calculate what, quote, the normal share of retirement is, and that's what goes into the employee share, and that employees should pick up 50% of that, and the other 50% just gets dumped into the employer share. For those of us that have retirement systems, that's largely transparent. I don't know that we see that this is something CalPERS, if you have CalPERS, calculates. That amount is capped at 8% for any existing employee. So even if the normal share of retirement is 20%, so 50% of that would be 10%, the Act actually specifies that normal share can't be more than 8%. So it's 50% of whatever the normal share is, as long as it doesn't exceed 8%. So there's been some confusion about what is that number. You really have to talk to the individual retirement systems to determine what is the normal share of retirement to determine what is 50%. And so we have in the material some background information on what does PEPRA require. That's more informational. It really isn't on the funding methodology subcommittee to talk about whether courts should or should not implement provisions of PEPRA at any particular point in time. We're talking about the methodology, not what each court's decisions are related to their employees. There's been some question about whether or not PEPRA requires that existing employees, when the law was passed, need to pay that full member contribution when 2018 or whatever the year is rolls around, and the answer is no, that's not a requirement. It's at that point employers can begin to impose that, or there are certain provisions around how that imposition would happen that are different in 2018, but that isn't a strict requirement. So I know that background is helpful, but really what's before us is how do we want to address this in WAFM in terms of need, not in terms of whether courts pay it or courts don't pay it. We had this discussion when we built WAFM about if my court wants to negotiate with our union and we decide that, I'm not saying we're going to do this, but if we decided we wanted to give a COLA to our members that was 500%, I'm going to pick a number that, of course, never happened. Our court would have to do that within the allocation that we receive, and that's a local bargaining issue. The question for us really is this the same thing or is this different? And I think that's the dialogue that we need to have, is should WAFM be building in what courts are currently paying for the EPMC? Is that fair or should it not? And should that not be calculated as part of the need, but instead as part of what each of us have to deal with locally and looking at our total allocation and the total amount of money we receive? Does that difference make sense? I just want to make sure what we're not talking about here is telling a court what they do or do not have to do. That is up to their local bargaining and, you know, local culture.
So Jay, let me just kind of kick things off. The historic methodology for funding benefit costs up until this point was limited to the employer costs, the increase to the employer cost. That's how we have been operating up until this point, perhaps. The WAFM methodology was to contemplate a factor that recognizes local costs, right? We're not funded anywhere near that amount. And until that seems to be the solved, it seems to me that we should hang on to this other piece that addresses the funding need, the actual funding need of each court based on the growth, not on what they're paying for the employees on their behalf, but rather the actual costs that we sustain. And if we consider changing that, then courts would then be suffering both from an underfunding of the actual costs as well as not being funded sufficiently on the other side through WAFM. And so I think that's something that needs to be considered. If we open it, well, maybe I'll hold my other comment for others to speak up. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts.
David, just to clarify, when you say the growth, you're talking about the growth in the employer share?
Each year. Right.
Each year.
Okay.
So let me see if I can understand this piece. So there's two things that are going on, right? So one is we have the WAFM model, which is looking to calculate need, right? And that's total need for each of us. And like Mike said, we're not getting anywhere near fully funded for that total. Separately, what's happening now on the funding side, right, is that we do have what happened this year, accepting the $22 million, is that increase of the employer share of retirement or any increase in health care or medical costs were funded through the legislature and the governor, and they've committed to funding those next year. So we do have two kind of separate things. We're not talking about how that funding may be addressed and increases. I think that still moves along its path. The question is, within the funding need as we calculate it, how do we address this EPMC? You'd still be showing any increase in our employer-paid contribution would still go into WAFM, and that would still increase your need. So if you remember, then what happens is our need goes up. We then add in any of the benefit funding that we receive through the general fund as WAFM-related funding when we do the calculation on percent funding, right, the far right side of the column.
Yes.
Right. So what you're concerned about is we don't want to be impacting not getting that incremental growth off the employer share while also changing what the funding need looks like.
Right.
That you'd end up getting double. And I don't think we get there. So I think we had Rick and then Mike and then Judge Walsh.
It sounds like to me that what we're trying to wrestle with is the fundamental question of whether the pickup of the employee share is a benefit, just like the employee payment of the employer share, or is it something really different? And back when I used to do compensation work, we would always call it a cash add-on, because really the net effect is to put more money into the employee's paycheck. You're not increasing the retirement benefit in any way. So that, for example, if I'm not paying any of the employee share and I negotiate an agreement where I now pay 3%, it's just like giving a 3% COLA to the employee. That's the net effect. In fact, that's why many agencies have picked it up in lieu of giving a COLA outright, probably in many cases for political or other reasons. So if we're going to determine that it's not really a benefit as much as a cash add-on, it probably, I would think, maybe should be handled as a COLA or an increase in salary through the WAFM model as we have in the past in the state.
For the mic.
Do you want to go to the person
on the phone? Is that Judge Earl or Sherry?
Well, I was going to say that's an interesting way to look at it that Rick had just mentioned, but if that's the case, WAFM already takes care of that through the salaries.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so that means that there would have to be a way where that cash add is not submitted as an actual cost should courts choose to do that. I think that's a really interesting concept because it would already be taken care of.
Mike?
To back up what David is saying, the only increases we're seeing for those of us that have employee offsets are on the employer contribution mm-hmm. side. And, I mean, let's be honest, with what the governor has put forward as his policy position, that he doesn't care what PEPRA says about 2018, he wants us to do it now, we're all going to be in a situation of trying to reduce that that match, as opposed to expanding that match, which, as Rick has indicated, is in some ways an effective way to improve salary and improve take-home pay with it at less cost than a straight cost of living adjustment. And so I think this is the bridge issue about how we get from the historical situation largely driven by our county systems and county negotiations to the new kind of WAFMized type system and what the governor is indicating, we have to extricate ourselves from these historical agreements. And as we've discussed before, that's going to be a meet-and-confer issue, and it's going to be a contentious meet-and-confer issue for those courts that have nothing to bargain with. Because what we're seeing around the state, and I don't care whether it's the courts, police agencies, cities, special districts, is they're basically they're buying off the offset with increased salary. You know, and so for those of us who don't have that luxury, we're either looking at a straight pay cut or we never get there. And so I'm concerned about it because we've gotten locked in to something we didn't create and are now being locally held accountable for fixing it with nothing to work with.
And I think that's a really good point, and that is the problem that we need to address, but I'm not sure that should be addressed through options.
I agree, but you know, there's only so much money in the well, mm-hmm. and we're already siphoning it out, and then the governor wants to throw this on top of the argument. It's disgusting.
Okay. I need to follow up disgusting, but let me just first of all, I want to clarify. The way these papers are written, it kind of focuses on the agricultural discussion and other things having to do with how they got to the $42.8 million for to cover increases. But that's not actually today's subject, right? Today's subject is going back to Laughlin. We're not talking about, in fact, we already kind of decided that one last at the last one. But getting back to then what Mike said, first of all, I don't know about disgusting, but I can certainly vouch for contentious. Let's put it on the table in our negotiations. For me, they didn't agree to it when we suggested it last October, and we're still in negotiations. They haven't had a raise in 5 years. We're in Santa Claus County. The county just signed an agreement, 15% salary increase.
In 1 year, or?
No, 5 years. And that's the market we're in. So we get what the governor is saying. We totally get it. And we're on it, and we're trying to change it. But we were stuck with contracts inherited from the county. Mike's right. We have to negotiate to get out from under them in a very tough environment to succeed, but we're trying hard to do it. In my memory, my clear memory, of why this was treated differently in the initial Waltham is because, indeed, we were stuck. Many courts were stuck. And we got to get out from under it because we feel the other gun at our head in terms of what share of the increases might be ours down the road. But Waltham was a sudden and dramatic change, probably for the recipient courts and what I think they're not finding. Donor courts. I'm trying to come up with a better word, but you know who we are. And for us to ease that, I thought it was a pretty clear decision. Nobody was hiding the ball that for those bound by contracts, the benefits would be treated differently. Not that they should be forever, but for a long enough time so that we could try to get out from under them from the bounds we are stuck right now. That's my recollection.
Can I circle back and ask a question because I'm not sure? I just want to clarify, when you say you can't afford to pay the salary increase and you can't continue to pay that portion, right?
No, I didn't say that at all. What I'm saying is what we're seeing almost universally in public agencies is that they are offsetting that change with a pay increase. So let's just say I'm going to give you a 2% pay raise, and I'm going to reduce our court employee contribution by 2%. So for the employee, it's a wash. For the organization, it's not a wash because a 2% COLA costs more than a 2% retirement buyback.
Okay, so you have to adjust it a little bit. Because I was just,
right.
To me, it's just like shifting it from one side of the ledger to the other. But it's not a...
It's not a one-for-one. Number one. Number two, the way Waltham is set up, based on actuals, it doesn't move over to the salary bucket, it drops off. So you really have to have net assets, net income, in order to increase your salary base at the end of the day.
Right. So I know Mary Beth had a comment. But on that, I just want to clarify that's correct. I mean, the way that the Waltham is set up is if you provide a COLA, you're getting your allotment for dollars, right? And you're making that decision. It doesn't necessarily feed back in, right? You're evaluating what's going on with the market, and Waltham adjusts a little bit with the market based on how that dollar allotment is calculated. But Mike's right. I mean, the challenge here is that right now the need in Waltham. So again, we're talking need, not funding, and I want to be really careful about that. But the need right now is calculating in that employee paid member contribution, and if that goes away, then that's coming out of the need wholly. Now, from an expenditure standpoint, it's not quite a net. It's actually a little bit more expensive.
I'll give you an actual example because we've run the numbers, and it's just my situation. If I do a 2% pay raise, it costs me $3 million. And I offset that with a 2% reduction in the import contract in the court's match, that's $1.4 million. So it's going to cost me net $1.6 million to give a pay raise,
to buy that out.
Yeah. So for the employee, it's neutral. But for the organization, there's a net cost going forward.
I like the takeaway to the employee. I want to do less.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So Mary Beth.
Okay. I get it. Having been, you know, I'm a court in the same situation. I'm kind of screwing myself over because I'm getting out from under my employer-paid employee contribution and moving it over to salary. I guess for purposes, though, of the WAFM, I understand what the governor's doing, and I understand this is his political platform. It is not the branch's political platform. There's not, from what I've understood, any court out there that is not complying with PEPRA. We have to follow the law, and we're following the law. I'm hesitant to identify just because the governor has expressed a desire that we start carving out certain benefits and treating them differently. It's like, if we're going to open up benefits, then let's open up benefits. But I'm uncomfortable saying with the model, we're going to dig into the benefit piece of it to address only one benefit. I mean, Sherry started to make a comment earlier when you quoted Michael Cohen to say, you know, well, if we want to talk about, you know, what the state employees are getting, then let's open it up. My employees don't get retiree health. There are people in courts who do, and there are people in courts who don't. There is no parity in our benefits programs right now. So to try to carve out one little piece of it, I think we're micromanaging at that point. And I think for the reasons Mike's describing, there are legitimate business reasons to offer this contribution in lieu of salaries. It saves us money. There are legitimate reasons, to do these things, and I don't think we need to – two wrongs don't make a right, and I think we'd be adding on to the wrong, which is wrong to us, when this reduction was made to our benefits funding for the governor's political platform. I mean, I can't think of any other reason. We are complying with the statute. So, I mean, and to take it one step further, you know, Rick, I was a little confused by what you were trying to describe because I don't know how this contribution differs in any way, shape, or form to the contribution we make to health care or anything else. It's the more I contribute to their health care, the more cash is in their pockets. It's true of every benefit that we provide. So to try to treat it separately, unless we're going to look at this as a whole, I'm not opposed to maybe we need to rethink the benefits piece of it, but I am opposed to carving out one little benefit. I think that's micromanaging. I think there's no legitimate business reason. In fact, I think there are business reasons not to do it. So I would say I would not support making any change to the WAFM model with respect to just this one item.
Okay, we have Rick and then Judge Earl and then Mike.
For what Mary Beth said, I agree with that. And although I do think that there is a difference because there is an employer-defined fee and there's an employee-defined fee as opposed to other benefits. But I guess it's kind of a question, maybe Jake walk me through it because I'm still getting to know the WAFM model fully. Right now, WAFM determines the number of employees that we should have based upon. And it puts a price tag on those employees. And that price tag includes base salary, which is based upon an average statewide?
Correct.
Okay. And we have, in the past, I think up to now, left benefits out of that equation?
Yes.
And then we changed it to kind of a standard package or such. And so if that's the case, we've never really factored in the employees. I don't necessarily see a reason to do it now for the reasons that Mary Beth said, because there are other issues that need to, and this is, I was just trying to say, this is one that really blurs the line. And if we haven't in the past, it's true to what it is, which is a cash add-on,
So we would have to add that into the actual average base salary and recalculate, but I don't see a great need to what problem we would really be trying to solve, because if it's a cash add-on, it's just a kind of given a COLA like they have in the past, and we don't factor that in because that's an individual court decision.
Mike?
Yeah, I guess a couple of points, and at least one of my points goes well beyond Waltham, but it's something that we might want to talk about. Number one, you know, Mary Beth makes a very good point that I hadn't thought about in terms of varying levels of benefits. Yeah. Some courts, health benefits are tied to salary. They're a proportion of salary. In some cases, they're tied to the cost of plans. You know, the employee gets a specific plan at whatever that level is. In some cases, it's just simply a monthly pickup. So in that area, we're all over the board. Number two, in my case, all my new employees get zero pickup. And given the massive turnover and the ability that we've had to hire new staff, it applies to 3% of the workforce, because that's all we've been able to move over the intervening years, because everybody that went out went away. And the third thing is, if you really want to get to equity, parity, everybody's treated the same way, then you put all prospective court hires into a court retirement and benefit system. That's the same across the state like it is for other branch, other executive and legislative branch employees. That was something was talked about as far back as the Employee Protection Act in 01, and was dismissed out of hand because of all the local market conditions. But either we're willing to accept local variations and levels and impacts and so forth on this issue of benefits and retirement, or we start to move to a common system where everything's the same, and then you can budget that on a central level, and it becomes very much akin to what they're doing in the other two branches.
So, Judge Earl, just good.
Thanks, Jake. So, I appreciate that none of us feel we should be having to have this conversation because we are complying with PEPRA. But I think the question is one that we addressed back in June, and that is, we're not going to, from this governor, we are not going to get full benefit funding for retirement when the employer is paying more than 50% of the employee share. So what do we do going forward? How do we allocate that? How do we allocate benefits going forward for this? In June, we made the decision we're not going to address it yet because it's too late in the year to be able to figure out how to do that. But there was a strong contingent of members of our committee who felt that it was unfair to courts who were not making more than 50% of the contribution to have to essentially finance those courts that were, and I use that term loosely. So I think the question is, what are we going to do next year and in years forward when we don't get full benefits funding for the reasons that the governor has pronounced? How do we then allocate it? I think that's the issue before us.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to what Judge Earl just said, which is that Mary Beth is right, we're complying with PEPRA, but that's not the issue. The issue is that the Department of Finance has made it very clear that they're encouraging every branch of government to move towards those, they call it standards, even though it's not what the law says. So that funding is tied to that. So they say that they want to see us moving towards what they call the PEPRA standard, which is, I guess, the fact that in 2018 you may impose, although you're not required to. So let's say they're thinking that everybody should pay 50% or no more. We're in kind of a transition problem, which is that if we were now to take the benefits funding out of the WAFM need calculation, would make it that much harder for those courts to get to the 50% for the reasons that Mike said, because the reason you included an employer contribution in your benefits package was because it was a win-win. You could give somebody more money at less cost to you. So to undo that now, you're going to need a little bit more money, exactly as Mike said. So if at this point in history we take it out of WAFA, we're going to make it that much more difficult to fix the problem. And I think what we need to do is recognize that our arms are being held behind our back and our wrist is being pushed up towards our shoulder blade, and we've got to figure out a way to move towards the 50% standard. But I don't think we can do anything except encourage courts to be doing that over the next year or two as their union contracts come open. And then a couple of years from now, look back and say, was there somebody who had an opportunity to fix this who didn't? And maybe then you can talk about penalizing people the way Judge Earl said the comments were made last time. But I think it's much too early now, and if we do that now, we're going to make it that much harder to get full funding for the branch because we're disabling those courts from fixing it.
So, Judge Good, that's a perfect segue to what I was going to say. Two of the pretty large courts that contribute towards the employee share are Riverside and San Bernardino. Riverside already took care of their problem, and I'm about to take care of the problem. The whole thing is going to go away. So for us, which is a large quantity of this $22 million and a large quantity of the 5,000 people are or employees that are being contributed to by the branch. So I do think waiting and giving people an opportunity to fix this is a very wise decision. And before we make any significant plans, I think we should see where we're at. But I'm a little unclear on how that's going to help this year. If we're doing this fix in the middle of the year, how is the governor going to handle that?
Okay, so to answer that, and then Mary Beth has a comment. So I don't want to step on her. But what we're talking about here is not in the, about the current year, right? One of the things that we are really trying to do with WAFM from a just from a model standpoint, we want to make sure we all know in our, you know, in our day jobs, what can we expect for the following year a little bit earlier. And so what we're trying to get to the point is where we can start to work on things in the fall if we want to make changes, work through that process to approve so they can be in place for the next fiscal year by about February, March. And so really what we're talking about here is this was on our list for the year. I think, too, based on this discussion, I mean, there are a lot of things that are coming out of it related to, well, do we change it? The answer might be no. Do we change it after a period of time? Maybe. And so I think there's a lot of things we need to look at. Is it, you know, what impacts does it have? And so, you know, it's not on for action today. It's just a discussion. And I think we probably do need to get a smaller work group together to talk through all of those and what really are the implications and bring that back to the group. But before we get there, Mary Beth,
I just wanted to clarify. So when we kind of teed this up, it was do we change WAFM?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
A discussion about how we handle the political potential consequences of this issue. My comments were targeted to the WAFM model. Yeah, I think there still needs to be a conversation how we might incentivize courts to continue to move forward. But I don't want to see it done. My position would be not within WAFM, that whatever we do to address this issue is outside of WAFM. Because I do see it as a one-off. We can't ignore it. I want to make clear, I'm not advocating we ignore it, but I don't think we should start changing the model for something like this. I mean, this is a hopefully an unusual situation. I feel like we're going to be the word pawn comes to mind as far as this goes, but. So I think we could talk about incentivizing or promoting that courts move from this. If there are some strategies of how you do it, I don't know what those might be to so that courts are not as harmed as they move off of this. But I just want to make clear, my strong comments are I don't think we should start to mess with the model over one element, one benefit element. That does not mean that we don't have discussions on how this gets addressed otherwise or how we continue to encourage courts to get out of the crosshairs, which is where we are.
All right. Judge Walsh, then Rick, then Mike.
I agree with Mary Beth. And again, to be clear, I know they're related, but what is on the table now is not a discussion of that other $22 million problem, the missing money in the benefit increases that we voted last time. And for those, so I'm going to make a motion that we not modify WAFM at this time to factor in employer paid employer, EPMC, okay, employer paid
member contributions,
thank you. With, and I want to say that the impetus to those courts who are still doing it, or one of them, like San Bernardino, is not only do we know the governor's out there, but also we know the other piece, that $22 million piece. We made a decision for this year only. I know that's coming again. We told our employees that. You want an impetus? I'm worried about what you folks are going to do to me or our courts if we don't make reasonable progress to change it the next time we take a look at how to divvy up the increased portion. But the increased portion is not what's on the table right now. But I'm thinking about it. So I would make the motion that we not modify WAFM at this time to factor in EPMC.
Second that.
So here's a question, right, since we're into our new realm. I mean, this item's only on for discussion, not on for action. So I don't know if we can take action or not. I mean, I think certainly as we were looking I think as we were looking at this, this is one we figured we couldn't reach a conclusion today because there are a lot of different, you know, I know Rick wanted to talk and Mike and Judge Earl also. So I don't want to cut that off, but I don't know that we can take action or not. But they can you can go ahead, Rick.
Just a second. This is
one second, Earl. Go ahead, Rick.
Really what we're dealing with is a political question and I think related to Mike's concerns, an economic question, but not a workload question, so absolutely shouldn't be part of WAFM. The only thing I would say is maybe as we go through the analysis or we come out to whatever decisions that we make in terms of what are the ultimate effects on court so that we're not reversing WAFM in some way, but that's only a tangential relationship.
Yeah, I think Mary Duff's got a good point or a good idea. I mean, I think we need to put some concentrated subcommittee-type effort into trying to figure out how to move the rock for the few courts that have no hope in the near term of doing what San Bernardino and Riverside were able to do. Because we're the ones that are going to stick out like a sore thumb. When you can't get enough money in WAFM to cover what you're going to reallocate to other courts, and then you're talking about the political problem of how do you buy out the employer share, I think we've got to put some concentrated effort in thinking on that one. It doesn't affect the whole universe of courts, but maybe that's how we start to solve the problem is by focusing in on the real narrower question rather than the larger question. And I would also suggest we don't need to we shouldn't modify WAFM because then we'll have excuses in the future to modify it for anything. But this is it's a problem that's going, it's being reduced as courts are paying attention to and getting the resources to do it. But for a few folks that are going to be the outliers, there is no hope unless there's significant restoration to offset the reallocation of money that we're ever going to get there unless we lay off employees or reduce public access even further so that we can do this if we do it consistent with what other courts and agencies are doing, and that is to buy it out.
Okay, Judge Earl.
Thanks, Jake. This is only on for discussion. I do think action is premature on this. I agree with Mike. We need to put together, I think, a small work group to kind of flush out the issues. Just based on the discussion today, you can see there are a lot of issues. So the fact that it's not on for action, I'm going to ask that we not take a vote on it, that we put together a smaller work group, and that we bring it back to this subcommittee for more detailed discussion once that small working group has flushed it out.
Sure, I withdraw my motion. You clarify that.
Okay, so I think then it's a more generic. So the issue as it was presented here was specifically related only to WAFM. Now this is the funding methodology subcommittee. We had this discussion about the next item that's related to Court-Appointed Counsel. It isn't just about WAFM, right? I mean, this group is talking about funding methodology generally speaking, and so this item initially was written related specifically to employee share of retirement, but I think what Mike's point is the discussion needs to be, and it was related to WAFM specifically, but that if we get a small group together, the discussion is not necessarily isolated to addressing this within WAFM, right, but instead a discussion of this issue and how do we deal with funding
related to retirement. Is that fair?
Fair.
So, so we're not isolating it down to something. Really, there was a motion to say don't do that. So we don't want to limit it. So I think the only request we'd have there is if you want to email me or Judge Earl, if you're interested in being in that group, then we can get a small group formed and get that back pretty quickly.
I'm not clear on how you do that. We don't know who's going to be on this committee pretty soon here, right?
This one?
I can address that. I meant to put this on. It is on agenda item for the full committee meeting, I think, next week. I don't know if you have noticed that there was, I think it's closed now, there was a proposed amendment to the rule of court that defines membership of the Budget Advisory Committee was out for public comment. Zlotko and I submitted a proposed amendment that would allow immediate past presiding judges to continue serving. That public comment period has closed, and that issue will go before the Judicial Council at their October meeting. In light of that, all of the existing members of the Budget Advisory Committee, your terms will extend until December 31st. Sorry if there is anyone eager to get off this committee. And then at some point, and I don't remember when this is, maybe Bob or Zlotko can jump in, we will reopen the nomination period again. I believe there were some current committee members who did not reapply because they did not think they would be eligible. If the Judicial Council approves our amendment, there are some committee members who would continue to be eligible. So we are all going to continue to serve through the end of December.
So I guess with that said, our goal would be to maybe get this group together and have an output before the end of December. So it could be from this group and not have to transfer over, although it probably would then be reported back
to a new
group. So hopefully Mike's statement doesn't prove prosthetic. If we report to a different group who will be here, that they redo it. So if you're interested in volunteering, just email Judge Earl or me, and we'll go from there. Although I might not be in January either, so I guess we'll just deal with it between now and the end. I do want to mention one other thing on this item before we leave it, though. In the charts at the back, there is a table that lists the number of employees by percent. There are a couple of items that came up after the materials went out from specific courts where the numbers look a little bit, they kind of jump out at you for percentages that seem fairly high. So those courts, I believe, they did talk to the Judicial Council staff and indicated that a few courts were amending their 7A, where there might have been a data entry error or something. And so
it's as good as what we get, right?
Right. So on those that are, I think it was more like 64% or 67%.
Yes.
That court came back and said that's not accurate. Mm-hmm. That's not actually what's being paid for related to retirement. So just don't want to leave that out there, that if someone's looking at this saying, oh, my goodness, some court is paying 60-some percent on top of salary. That
I'm going to ask, Bob, if there's a revision, can we post revised materials with a disclaimer that it's been revised and updated if there was an error on that? Are we able to do that?
We can.
Although, can you give everybody address it with the full committee materials if this is going forward or not?
Okay,
but we can do that.
I just want to make sure there's a chance for everybody to know to update the information. I don't know if it was a submission calculation error or if it was just a calculation error.
Right. It was provided by the courts as part of the 7A, so folks have looked at it and gotten back. I don't know. Stephen, we've already been contacted by somebody to fix it.
Gotcha. You're saying these accurately reflect the 7A's. The errors were on the 7A.
Something on the 7A submittal.
Right. Okay. Anything more on item 3? Okay. So we have one item left. Does anyone mind just going through it, or do we need to take a break for lunch? Just take a break. We don't mind that. Well, I mean, to grab some.
Yeah, that's great.
So, okay. Okay. Then we will plot along. Let's see. Now, item number 4. So, dependency court appointed counsel. What page number are we on here? technology just failed me. So the payments to credit counsel, the issue here is related to the discussion of whether we want to adopt an alternative funding model for dependency code-appointed counsel. If you go to the materials,
just page 51.
Page 51. Page 51. Thank you, Blocko. There.
Good.
My technology is not cooperating. Okay, so page 51. So for those that don't know, as background, there's $103.7 million annually provided for dependency court-appointed counsel, which represents approximately 75% of the estimated need for that service. The allocations to each court do vary widely, as is stated here, and in some cases, courts receive an amount significantly below the calculated need, and in other court cases, courts receive an amount that is above the need calculated by that methodology. So by way of some background, taking a step back, our existing dependency court-appointed counsel funding is based largely on whatever the court had for that amount of money or that expenditure in some year prior to 2001. So I don't know what that year was exactly where that amount was set, but in 2001 was when the council modified how dependency court-appointed counsel funding is handled, and it went to a reimbursement basis where it could only be spent on dependency court-appointed counsel. So that amount was set at that point, but it was probably based on some dollar amount in years before that. As the years went on, back in 2000, and I'm going to skip over some of the draft on the next page, on page 52, there's a chart of sort of a timeline here. Back in 2006, 2007, there was some work that was done to develop a standard for caseloads for dependency court-appointed counsel. So at the time, the Trial Court Budget Working Group, I believe, was the one that formed a subgroup to work on a methodology for dependency court-appointed counsel funding. And so that group, working with the Center for Children, Families, and the Courts, developed, through an extensive survey, a caseload model for the number of clients per attorney, a funding methodology, or a estimated need calculation related to that, that looked at salary differences in cost of living or cost of services in various areas, and they developed a structure that would estimate how much we need for dependency court appointed counsel. And that's how we get to the $135 million that we estimate today in terms of need. That model was never specifically adopted, although the methodology was adopted by E&P in 2008. That was related to how to calculate the need, but the allocation or a change in the allocation of our funding was never addressed. I was on that working group as a on behalf of my then court executive officer, the discussion there was that courts need time, and we all enter into contracts with dependency court-appointed counsel, and that there would need to be some time in order for courts to move if they had more money than the model said they needed. You know, you can't just stop tomorrow. I mean, there is a contract. And so that group had contemplated a phased approach to moving towards the model that wasn't ultimately adopted. I couldn't tell you why necessarily. I don't remember. But it didn't move forward. Then in 2010, the Trial Court Budget Working Group did recommend to the Judicial Council to reduce court-appointed counsel funding to the baseline of $103.7 million. So those that remember, court-appointed counsel was spending about $110 million. Correct?
Yes.
Prior to that, but that $7 million difference was always reallocated from the jury fund over to court-appointed counsel. And so each year there was more being allocated than was actually earmarked for court-appointed counsel because there was money left over in the jury fund. And as the funding sort of collapsed for all of us, that was no longer possible to divert that money. And so it was reduced down to its base of $103 million. So those reductions were phased over 2 years, and that was done. Those reductions were tiered into three separate tiers depending on where courts fell based on their funding compared to their calculated need for dependency court-appointed counsel using that funding model that was adopted by E&P. So some courts received no reduction, some courts received a slight reduction, and some courts received a larger reduction, all depending on which of the three tiers they sat in. Last year, there was a request that went in as a BCP to augment dependency court-appointed counsel so that it would equal the amount of need for that program that ultimately was not included in the Budget Act. So that's sort of the background on it. And so now what has come to us is that a number of times it's been raised
should we change the funding model? You know, we have a way of calculating funding need for dependency court-appointed counsel. There is variability between the percent that courts are funded compared to that model, and should we start addressing that, whether with new money when it comes in or in the absence of new money? And so that's been sent to our group for review and to take any action on if we decide to do so. So that's the background. Any questions on that so far?
Chick, I think we should point out that the letter that we received addresses this subject.
It does. Okay. I haven't seen it yet, so.
The public comment.
Okay. So the public comment is on this item. I haven't read it yet, but okay. So I want to keep moving a little bit here. You can see how the model is sort of broken down in attachment 4C, which is on page 54 if you're looking at it electronically. And you can see that it breaks down the average number of children in dependency. It then estimates the number of parents based on a proportional factor to get a total number of clients. It then uses a 188 clients per attorney to calculate the number of attorneys that would be necessary. It then adds in some social workers and investigators. Then applies salary costs there as you go down. Benefits. And then you ultimately get to a general caseload funding model, as you can see there in sort of bold. And so this is just walking through a couple of courts and how they would calculate. So then if you continue on to 4D, attachment 4D, which is page 54, this shows for each court what their number of clients are, what the estimated total clients are, and then what the funding need is using this model for each of those courts, and then what their current allocation is. On the far right in column F, it then shows you a percent. So a percent that is above 100% indicates that their current allocation is greater than what this funding this need would suggest is required, you know, based on this methodology. You know, certainly we are talking about dependency court-appointed counsel, so like most of the things we talk about, you know, to the extent that there is more money, then that may mean there's more time for those attorneys to spend with their clients in representing them. So not saying they don't need the money. And then the other courts, you can see if it's below 100% means that they are receiving less funding than the model would suggest they need in order to maintain that caseload level. And it shows as a fact sheet also, but I don't need to do that. So.
I just had a question, Jake. What is allocated?
When the draft program works, the judicial counsel for the 20 courts in the draft program will negotiate their contracts, and at this point, that is the amount that is not allocated in draft contracts, and so it's a. It's a sum that generally gets expended on conflict costs or extraordinary costs in the draft program.
So, but that's a fund balance essentially that actually would be properly drawn down to associated expenditures.
No. I don't think that's how the draft works. I was on the 2008 committee that started to look at the inequities in dependency counsel funding, and the way it was created is it took some courts that received more funding than that had a higher percentage of funding based on their caseload with courts that had a lower percentage of funding. They merged the funding together in order to try to create equity within the draft courts. As you can see, it has not necessarily helped because we haven't addressed the large issue of equity across all 58 counties.
I have a question. I'm assuming on page 54, the red are the draft courts.
Yes.
There's an extraordinary range in column F for the draft courts, where some are getting half of what they need, and some are getting almost more than 1.5 times what they need. Why is the draft formula creating that kind of inequity?
The draft formula still works essentially within the boundaries of the what the court brought in to the draft program, what it was spending at the time it came into the draft program. There's been an effort over time to negotiate the contract so that we could reallocate funding, but as you see, particularly with Los Angeles, which is in the draft program, that has those reallocations have provided nothing like what's needed to make it an equal share across the draft county.
So the what we see on 4C is not the draft formula. The draft formula has more history to it.
Yeah. What you see on 4C is how we calculate the need for every court in the state, and that's just the need, not what they get, but how we calculate what the Judicial Council standard of 188 clients per attorney would cost in each of these courts.
The question is, should an alternative funding model be implemented for? And just in looking at this chart, where some of them are as low as 3% of what their estimated need is, and some of them have twice as much. So we should have another working group to look at this and to formulate a model for how it should be distributed.
I would second that motion.
Jake, can I ask a question?
Sure.
As I understand it, the funding need for court-appointed dependency counsel is determined by this methodology that was approved by the council in 2008. But allocations aren't made that way, right? Funding allocations are made by or determined by historical spending levels. So the methodology that was approved by the council was never used for funding allocations, only to determine funding need. Is that right?
Other than in allocating the $7 million reduction, that is correct.
Okay.
Well, you know, again, to provide a little history, one of the first committees I was assigned to was the Dependency Council to look at the inequities back in 2008 and 2009. And a methodology was looked at that time, and I know I've raised it at least 4 times at the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee meetings. Every time we talk about Dependency Council and how critical it is that we find a way to make this a little bit more equitable based on actual need. The methodology was never finished, partly, I think, because Leah was in charge of it and is now the CEO in Almeda, but partly because there were phases. And so it was going to, through phase time, reallocate the funding, the limited funding that was going to Dependency Council based on the number of clients. And so I absolutely agree that we need to do this. It's been recognized since 2008 that it's been a problem, and we haven't done anything to fix it.
Okay. So I think that does sound like another working group for us here to try and get some information back in December before we transition over. Judge Walsh?
Is the suggestion to just look at the allocation based on the six-year-old funding model, or the suggestion to relook at that funding model as well to see if it's still viable?
I don't think that the discussion is isolated. I mean, I think right now we're just saying, is this something we want to look at? I think the answer sounds like it's yes. I do know, I mean, I'll just speak for, I mean, Don can jump in, but I know they went through a lot of effort to build this model. They surveyed the attorneys, and, I mean, I can't remember everything that went into it, but I think whatever group this is they formed is going to want to see, just like we did initially with the Waltham model, right? Well, how we based it on RAS. Okay, well, how was RAS created initially? What was all the work that went into it? I mean, I imagine this group is probably going to want to do the same thing about a lot more detail about how did this get calculated, who was maybe something that was viable, all that sort of discussion. But
I've heard, not that there's a flaw in the model, there's a flaw in the allocation process.
Yeah.
Maybe that narrows our focus. But I think without an extensive effort to revisit the underlying model, which you're right, they put lots and lots of work in that, is the question really the allocation question?
Well, I think that personally the group should look at both and then come back with recommendations. It might be the model is still fine, but we need to address the allocation. It might be the model is old at this point and we need to tweak it. So I would leave that up to the working group to kind of review it and see whether or not it still applies.
Fair enough.
I would question whether falls under budget to actually look into the model, but we may have to consult with another advisory committee on that piece, I would expect.
Say that again, Mary Beth, I'm sorry.
I'm not so sure that the underlying model falls under budget advisory committee. If nothing, I think we would have to consult with at least the Family and Juvenile Advisory Committee on that piece of it.
Well, I would look at the historical process we used before, but yeah.
We've got more about being involved in allocations regardless of where they, you know, so it is always a collaboration.
Right, so we talked about allocation and the model.
Sure.
Allocation, absolutely. The model itself, I think, gets a little, we would have to bring in other people to have that discussion.
I mean, I think from my perspective, it's just, and speaking as a member here, not sitting in the front right now, but I think we would want to lean, to Mike's point, I mean, in some cases here, we're trying to deal with the allocation because there's potentially an acute problem with the allocation that we need to start addressing. And again, we have contracts, so it's not like you can snap your fingers. People have existing contracts with their vendors. Let's talk about how does that work. But we want to be careful not to delay any action on that because we want to go back through and have to talk to other advisory committees to modify the underlying model. So
I think
if we're all kind of thinking, well, we know we need to make some change in the short term, maybe this is a longer, a multi-tiered process.
I agree. So a two-phase, maybe where we look at the allocation as our priority, and if we see something that needs to be referred for a long term, we could refer for them to consider if it's regarding the model.
Well, it's already been said, but I agree, because if the model's flawed, ultimately the allocations will be flawed. So it is something we have to look at, but I do agree that it needs to be a short-term strategy.
Yeah.
May I ask just a question? So I guess the red ones are the draft courts. What are the blue and white?
I think that's
just
to separate.
Something Excel did to make the lines look different.
Got it. Thank you.
It's Microsoft's fault. Okay. All right. So if volunteers for that item, if you'd like to be interested in that one, either on the benefits issue or on the Defense Career Point Council, if you could email Judge Earl or me. I think the idea there is both of those groups would start meeting fairly quickly and ideally finish up. Well,
so
if
we
they, if they can reach a report.
Did we need that motion?
We didn't do a motion on the last one.
That's fine.
To form a work group?
There was one out there, so I didn't want to.
You don't need it, I'll withdraw it.
Okay, I don't think we need it. Do we form work groups? Formal motion?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, they're limited duration. They're not going to be something that.
Right.
We're going to have to get approval from EMP on that creation. That I can recall.
So we'll be working on getting a report back before the end of the year. So
this is up to me, so this is just brain power.
Right. It would come back here before it would move on.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So then the last item is item A at the end, the work plan. So this is just informational, just so everyone is aware what is still on the work plan for this subcommittee ongoing. You'll see in spring we had two items. One was looking at complex litigation cases. This is on the very final page of the materials. That item is pending with the review of the Improvement and Modernization Fund, and so a different group. And the second one was evaluating additional staffing in multiple locations, and so that was we did take that on in the spring. So for this fiscal year, there were three primary items. One was how to allocate reductions, which obviously we discussed earlier today. Second and third are the two subgroups that we have just formed related to more broad number two related to benefits and then number three on the Career-Appointed Council. So those are the two major activities for this year, again, with the theory being that we want to try and do our work really in the fall so we can be presenting recommendations and move those through the Budget Advisory Committee and the Council if that's necessary, so we all understand more clearly in the spring what is the model going to look like for the following year so there aren't changes later in the year where we're all kind of juggling and have some certainty. And so
we're kind of looking at this, generally speaking, with activity being in the fall, as we may look at changes if necessary, to then have that approval go through if necessary in the spring, so we all have some confidence going into budget year.
How flexible.
Yes.
What did we mean?
Sorry, that stalled. But we'll get it going.
Should it be on this list?
Yes, I think it should.
It's still pending. It's still pending. So.
We're pending with our group or the same
with
our
group?
It's with our group.
The working group.
Oh. And then it shows you sort of the future, what we may be considering in future years, just as more informational than anything. So any questions on that? All right. Anything else we should be discussing?
Any topics that you've thought of while we've been here before the meeting started that we should raise for the next meeting? We clearly have added plenty as we've gone along, but is there anything, anybody on the phone?
Okay. Then that's it. We'll adjourn.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thank you, everybody, for joining on the phone. Thank you for coming to the meeting today.
Thank you.
And,
thank you, Jake.